From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during the early modern period in northwestern Europe, in countries like the Netherlands. That's where traders developed the first chartered joint stock companies, the first stock exchanges, and the first banking and insurance institutions. It was the beginning of what we now know as modern capitalism. Those early capitalists saw bubbles and stock market crashes, just like we have. Theirs dated back to 17th century Holland. But it didn't all go poorly for the Dutch. In fact, they were pioneers in the rise of the capitalist world system. German economist and sociologist Werner Sombart said, quote, "In the Netherlands, an entire people became imbued with a capitalist spirit, so much so that in the 17th century, Holland was universally regarded as the land of capitalism par excellence. It was envied by all other nations who put forth their keenest endeavors and their desire to emulate it. It was the high school of every art of the tradesman and the well-watered garden wherein the middle-class virtues throve." End quote. And who knew that the past tense of the word thrive is throve? But capitalism is having a rough stretch in the United States. A new poll this summer from Gallup finds that Americans age 18 to 29 in particular prefer socialism to capitalism, a huge shift in just a few decades. Only 45% of young American adults view capitalism favorably. Last month on Connections, we welcomed guests who explained why they feel some form of socialism is better for the United States. Today, we get the defense of capitalism, and we explore whether it can be improved from within, essentially whether capitalism can police itself. Our guests this hour include Andrew Brady, who is a board member for the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation, CEO of the Accelerate team, founder and co-chair of the local chapter of Conscious Capitalism, and who knows lots of people in that 18 to 29 category. Nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Alan Ziegler, president of the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation, and it's always nice to see Alan back here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And also with us is Dr. Rama Yelker, who is dean and professor of marketing in the School of Business at St. John Fisher College. Dr. Yelker, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Pleasure to be here.
As the youngest guy at the table, I'm going to turn to Andrew first with this and just ask you, generally speaking, if these poll numbers that Gallup finds, and let me just read a little bit more, and then I'll ask you if they sort of reflect what you hear. 51% of young people they feel positive about socialism and its potential. 45% have a positive view of capitalism. And Bankrate surveyed young Americans. About 4 in 10 Americans of all ages now hold some kind of second job. And as for millennials, more than half, 51%, have some type of what they call the side hustle. So that's part of why, you know, millennials in particular have a negative view of capitalism. Is that what you hear in general?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't know when they chose the term conscious capitalism, if they were all that great with marketing, because half the people I talk to, they hate the word conscious and the other half hate the word capitalism. So I'm pissing everybody off. So you know, when we're talking about conscious capitalism, it's really a foreign concept to a lot of people. Capitalism has lost the narrative. I mean, when you look, though, historically, you look at the differences between North Korea, South Korea. I mean, you can even look at the satellite pictures from space and see the level of development just based on the lighting and things between those two countries. Or you look at East Germany, West Germany, in the different things that happen there. And so there's no doubt that capitalism has a way of unleashing potential and unleashing a dynamism. But there are drawbacks that I'm sure we'll talk about today about some of the things that have led to those millennials and people of my generation questioning its value.
And to be clear, you're here and you do the work you do with conscious capitalism because you believe it's the system that can do the best for the most people. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so when you do see these negative views among younger Americans, is it because it's more marketing problem or more actual substantive problem in practice?
You know, it's a great point, and I think that it's a little bit of both. You know, there's certainly actually if you look at countries and companies, and you put them on the same list based on the revenues of those companies versus the GDP of countries, it's something like 65 of the top 100 would be companies that companies are larger than many entire country GDPs at this point. And so when those companies become in and business becomes a part of those dominant kind of institutions on the planet, they have to assume some of that social responsibility. And some of the largest companies, the Walmarts or the Exxon Mobils or whatever it is, haven't really started to assume that societal purpose like the governments that they're sort of replacing on that top 100 list.
No, it's interesting to think about them as being effectively their own little nation states. They're that big. There's that much concentration of economic power. Interesting place to start there. Dr. Yelker, I wonder how you feel when you work with your students, for example, at St. John Fisher College, if you're hearing suspicion of capitalism.
I think I have heard that opinion, and there's mixed reviews of how students feel. And we have to understand, we teach business students. You know, they become CPAs, they become bankers, they are HR professionals. So the perspective that we hear may be slightly different, but I am hearing this. And I really think, Evan, that the mindset is more about how the workplace is functioning rather than capitalism in itself. So they are concerned about the styles of management used, the inherent stereotype of a type A style of management associated with capitalism, which our millennials are not used to. They haven't grown up that way. They have a different philosophy, and they like to be told to figure out how to do something. They don't like to be told to do something and not know why. So I think there is this underlying assumption that capitalism is associated with these workplace cultures, and I think that's part of what it's driving, I think. And I personally, I grew up working for my own family business in India, and this is all I know. You know, it's private equity, how it supports the economy, and we are seeing that in Rochester as well, and many other states that I've lived in and worked in before.
Let me read a quote that I saw on MSNBC. This comes from Alyssa Quart, who is the executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She told CNBC that wages are not keeping up as day-to-day costs continue to rise. And she told them, quote, start blaming the system or start blaming the deeper causes of your economic fragility and instability. There are forces that are constructed against you, everything from your taxes to whether you can have job security at all, end quote. Too extreme, or you think that's a fair critique?
Well, I think there's some substance to it, but there are many other factors that are involved in creating that opinion. Today we see, I don't want to get into details of that, but the tax policies, the tax changes, and how they actually impact trade with other countries and trade deficit, unemployment rates, and a variety of those things come together to, it's not just one thing, get ready to face the future and it's going to be horrible, but it's a variety of policies and tax implications and international trade that is impacting this, and it's a more complex issue, Evan. We can talk about that, those aspects in detail, but there is some substance to it, because that is the perception in that quote, that things are going to be bad. And but here's the deal, we millennials don't think about, we have companies that are monopolies like Netflix, mm-hmm. right, like Google. We still continue to use them. Anheuser-Busch InBev, which is an international monopoly in the beverage beer industry. So
is that a problem? Too much economic concentration?
Well, it is, and that's why we have this laissez-faire type of policies where we limit the monopolies in industries, and we are watching them, and there are regulations to have too much of that. But yet, in certain industries, we have them, and they are creeping up, without people paying close attention to it.
Yeah, I would say there's some real debate about whether we've done much to limit monopoly at all, or at least not in the way that the Brandeis era used to do. Let me turn to Alan Ziegler, who is with the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation. And I will just say, they've got their annual ETHIs coming up, the Ethical Business Awards. I'm always proud to MC that event, because I don't know many organizations that really are as true blue devoted to a cause like Alan and this group that Raybef is. the criticism I hear from friends who have these doubts say that you are fighting sort of a losing cause because capitalism itself, it's designed to reward winners and create losers, and that this is always going to be the case. And I wonder if you find that too cynical, or if you think, again, that critique has got some merit.
I would end up on the cynical side. You know, one of the things we've done with Raybef is to not have winners, because with winners you have losers, but rather we have recipients to try and get away with that. But in candor, it hasn't worked. Those who receive the award call themselves winners, and I know that some of those who don't leave the room thinking I'm some kind of a loser. So I don't know.
I'm laughing because you can't inject socialism into a system that rewards capitalism, Alan.
Right. but I think the big issue is the fact that I don't think either of those terms are well understood by the millennial generation. Somebody said, you know, capitalism has a marketing problem. And so does socialism, because most people think, well, if the government does something, then we're socialist. But socialism is a way bigger concept than just the government taking over driver's licenses or something. So I think there's just a lack of understanding. But I think what there is there's a huge amount of frustration. This younger generation leaves college with large loans. 40% of kids who start college after 6 years haven't graduated. Those kids have spent tons of money, their families have spent money, and they're bereft. They don't have a job, they don't have much of a future, they're probably never going back to college. So it's that look of sort of desperation, of not seeing anything positive in the future, and so they lash out to the system. And the system has some problems. The income separation is a horrible problem. And I'm a huge fan of conscious capitalism and the work that Andrew is doing, because what it's doing is saying if the capitalistic economy would take responsibility for doing some of the things and not being so greedy, using some of that money for the public good, we wouldn't have these discussions about socialism or the government creeping into what could be the solution of these endemic problems.
This is why I wanted this panel here this hour, because they are not here to say capitalism is perfect. They're here to say that the system is the best possible system that we can have, and there are legitimate problems right now as people see them, and there's ways forward. Now, Andrew, on the conscious capitalism side, a lot of the critics of conscious capitalism are not critics of your desire to see businesses do good for the world per se. They would argue that it's akin to saying to football players, look, we are not going to have referees. What we want you to do, though, is protect the quarterback. And guys, you know, don't hit the head. You know, go easy. We're not going to flag you, but you'll feel better if you play the right way. Well, how many players are out there are going to say, well, there's no referees on the field, so guess what? Maybe 1 out of 10. But it's never going to be enough to have a fair, safe field for everybody. And that's what some of the criticisms of conscious capitalism, that what you're doing is a great fight, and it's ultimately destined to fail. So let's hear it from you then, because I know you feel like it's an uphill battle, but it's one worth fighting, and it's not necessarily destined to fail.
Yeah, well, I think in some ways it comes down to making the individual choices that reflect that. You know, I think that where do you go and spend your money? Do you spend it in a way that is, you know, conscious, so to speak, in terms of trying to find companies that align with your values? Do you invest? Last time I was on the program, we were talking about social impact investing and talking about, you know, to what extent you can be socially responsible in the way that you're investing. So it is in some ways on all of us. But another piece that's really bringing this conscious capitalism to the forefront and leading to, you know, these companies are actually, over the long term, more successful, you know, even by bottom line metrics, even by their stock price metrics. And in a lot of ways, that's because of this level of transparency that gets created in today's world, when everybody's got a cell phone in their pocket and they can broadcast things around the world. And so when you have you know, a good or a bad experience with a company, you can tweet about it. You can put it on Facebook. And so those companies that for a very long time have been doing the right thing, they are now, based on that transparency, getting more and more positive buzz and bringing more people, whether that's more customers, whether that's investors, whether that's getting the community to surround and support and want to uplift them. But that kind of transparency allows for more companies to do well by doing good, because you can't today. I remember kind of a formative moment for me, I guess, in like the 90s when Nike, you know, puts out all these great ads about how excellence in these things that are really important to them, and then you find out that they've got sweatshops in developing countries and things, right?
Exactly.
And so when now that transparency that gets created because of our cell phones, because of the internet and those sorts of things, you can't keep those things a secret anymore. And so you really see that there's a level of authenticity, right? You can't just put out a marketing message and expect that to be the narrative of your organization, because equally, if not more important, is what people are saying and what people are experiencing.
So just guess here, and this is totally unfair, but I'm going to ask you this question.
Uh-oh.
What percentage of American companies do you think are behaving in a way that you would say is in line with conscious capitalism values?
You know, what I think, it's hard to put a percentage on it, so let me sidestep your very difficult, unfair question.
It's totally unfair.
and instead say that, you know, I think that, for example, conscious capitalism started from a book called Firms of Endearment that looked at what was it that set companies apart that were, you know, the Googles and the, you know, Wegmans was mentioned in the book, and they talked about they had a higher purpose beyond making profits. They had a stakeholder orientation that balanced the needs of the customers, the community, the employees, the environment, you know, in addition to the stockholders. And they had conscious leadership and culture that really embodied the purpose and lived the values of the organization. And I would say that when that book came out in 2007, you know, it set a standard, but these companies are continuing to raise the bar. There's some companies like Patagonia, for example, who continue to say, what more can we do to be more socially conscious, to be more transparent about the social impact or the environmental footprint of the products that we're putting out. And so I'd like to think that it's a race to the top, that they're continuing to move farther and farther towards conscious capitalism when that transparency gets created and when people start to believe in that and want to invest their dollars, whether that's as consumers or as investors in those companies. And so I'd say that you know, it's a lot easier, just like any kind of news story, where it's a lot easier to get attention when you tell the bad story sometimes. But I think for the most part, especially with small businesses, you know, small businesses that are embedded in their community, that there's a lot more conscious capitalism going on than gets told. And that's why we're here. And that's why I thank you for inviting us here to be a part of kind of shifting that narrative.
Okay. Well, Senator Brady, you're right. You didn't answer the question. I think, I think you gave a really interesting answer. And I'm glad to start naming names here. Patagonia, there's a number, and I see them their name, for example, come up a lot. And I also think Andrew's making a really good point, too. Some of the public backlash tends to fall on bigger companies, sometimes fairly or not. But think about the small businesses, 3 employees, 5 employees, 10 employees. I mean, they're certainly doing a lot of public good just by existing and employing. And so I take that point. But Senator, would you say it's more or less than half of the companies you think that are in line with the values you want?
If we're looking at maybe like companies that are on the S&P 500, I'd probably say it's less than half, you know, of the larger companies. And then like you're saying, you know, I'd say probably 3/4 of small businesses, you know, just by their nature and being smaller, being embedded in their community, giving back to their community, I'd say it's much more than half in the smaller businesses.
All right. So listeners, I want to hear from you as we go throughout this hour. What are your thoughts on capitalism? Is it working? Does it work for you, for the country? Are you happy with it as a system? Are you someone like the majority of young Americans, 18 to 29, who is now suspicious or has a negative view of capitalism? It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I would guess that we are not going to see those numbers get better until the wage gap improves. Dr. Yelker, do you agree with that? And are there immediate remedies for that, if you think that that's true?
Well, you know, I'm going to step back a little bit. I was listening to, you know, what Andrew was saying and the kinds of questions. When we educate our business students and parents send them to college because they want them to be employed and, you know, get out of the house and not come back and live in their basement and those kinds of things. When we train students to interview for jobs, we say it is equally your responsibility to ask that company what their values are and moral code of ethics are. So I tell them, don't be shy about asking the company some tough questions, and also don't be shy about telling the person that you're interviewing with what your own work ethic is. Because I think what's so unique about our students, and I can talk about Fisher and in general students in our region, is that they have a great work ethic. Not necessarily so that we may find in other parts of the country or other schools or elsewhere. So to ask very boldly about the moral codes and ethical principles of the company, and if they don't agree with them, it's okay not to take that job.
Okay, Alan, do you agree? Do you think that number one, that that's a good starting point, that educating people on the increasing number of companies that really have much more explicit mission statements that are more than just marketing, that are ethical foundations for the company, that I know you have tried to not only find here in Rochester, but promote through the Ethical Business Awards. Or how do you see it? Do you think wages is a problem? How do you start fixing that image of capitalism?
Well, I think the wage gap is a major problem, but I just want to go back to something that Andrew was touching on. We have national statistics that being an ethical culture increases all of your financial metrics. Bottom line is up, your stock price goes up, your turnover is lower. So doing the right thing pays. I sense that we haven't been very successful in getting people to believe that.
No, hold on. I just want to ask you, and not snarky at all, an honest question here. Does that research, is that sort of a generally, a sort of a bird's eye view of how an ethical approach to business actually impacts bottom line, or is it sector by sector? In other words, does that really work on Wall Street, places where we see some of the most nefarious activity?
I'm quoting statistics from a couple of Harvard professors who over an 11-year period examined companies. Yeah. I don't know the companies.
Okay.
I suspect they were large companies.
Okay.
And Andrew, do you have a...
So I can say that the companies on the best companies to work for list, over the course of 10 years, they beat the S&P 500 by about 4 times. The companies that were mentioned in the firms of endearment, the conscious capitalism aligned companies, over the course of 15 years beat the market by about 10.5 times. And so these are organizations that, in the long term, maybe there's times where they have to take a short term hit because they are focused on purpose or are maybe paying their employees more. But the downstream impacts of that, when you have loyal employees, loyal customers, you have a community that wants to support you, it's really a no-brainer in the long term if you want to be a sustainable, enduring, successful company.
Do you think that would be true in the financial industry?
So
it would be true on Wall Street.
Yeah. So I mean, there was that big Larry Fink wrote the piece to everyone that BlackRock invests in. BlackRock's the largest institutional investor, however many billions of dollars that they control, and said that if you don't have a societal purpose, we're going to reconsider whether or not we should be investing in you. And so it has started to go mainstream where they are seeing that because there are higher returns, it should infuse every organization, no matter the industry.
All right. Go ahead, Alan.
I just want to pick up on one other thing that Andrew touched on. Ethics, and I think conscious capitalism, are cultural issues. You create that culture. That culture is created from the top. It's not a rule book. It's not a compliance code. It's the reality of how people behave, and it starts with the leader. And so to your point about small companies being more likely to be conscious capitalists, it's because it's much easier to create a culture in a small company. Because the CEO is around, he or she is visible. You see how they behave in all aspects of their life, not just what happens 8 to 5. They don't put on game face. They're the same person all the time. They're authentic. So from that perspective, small companies may lead this revolution. And hopefully, at least in this community, they could, because we don't have many big companies. The Ethies has trouble attracting large companies, and we're only looking at 150 employees or more. We get many more applications from small and medium-sized companies, and I think that really states the point or solidifies the point that the small company has an easier job of creating a culture of either ethical behavior, conscious capitalism, those kinds of things.
All right, so before we start taking some listener feedback, phone calls, emails, et cetera, to be fair to our guests as they defend capitalism, we've been talking about how to fix its problems. And give me that short postcard of when you meet someone who is saying, I've got a problem with capitalism. You say, no, look, you're missing the benefits, which start with what, Alan?
Well, they start with culture and then the economic benefits of capitalism. There's nothing else that can do it. This country will not be fixed. By the way, Webster tells us about socialism. I said, I don't think people understand it. It's a political and economic theory of social organization advocating state ownership and control of the means of production, distribution, exchange. It's not health care for everybody. It's a very specific total government control of the economic engine. If you give it some thought, I really don't think young people want to do that. Your point about using Google and all these other things, they don't want socialism. They'd like capitalism to get fixed, as would I. But I don't think they want socialism.
And I think to that point, to the extent that what you're saying is right, I think they have doubts about whether capitalism can get fixed.
And I don't blame them.
Okay. Okay.
I think it can, by the way.
Absolutely. Well, that's why you're here.
I can absolutely see why they would think that, because it keeps getting worse and worse. The wage gap keeps getting larger and larger. The jobs get fewer and fewer. More people in poverty. Those are not good signs. But corporate America could fix that if they cared.
Okay. Andrew, the benefits of capitalism on the short postcard.
Yeah, it comes down to what Adam Smith said about the invisible hand, right? That when people are acting in their self-interest, they are creating that level of dynamism where people are trying, and you know, entrepreneurs are giving it a go, and they're maybe succeeding and maybe they're failing, but then they do it again. And so when you have this invisible hand versus as Alan is mentioning, kind of this central plan, it's just like in a company. When a company puts together their 3-year strategic plan, it takes about a month until the industry changes or something unforeseen happens. You can only predict so much. And so when you have central planning or some element like that, you can't foresee everything that's going to happen. Mike Tyson, you know, said that everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face. So, you know, you got a great plan, but when you have capitalism, it's so much more dynamic. It's so much more flexible and adaptable. And that's really what creates, you know, being able to listen to the market, being able to test things out, being able to try and fail, and sometimes succeed. That's what creates capitalism that can respond to really the market needs and create so much of the technology that we enjoy today.
Yeah, I, before I turn to Dr. Yelker for that, I would just follow up by saying our guests who were here a month ago pointed to Denmark, which is almost always on the top 10, sometimes top 5 lists of indicators for innovation, despite a lot of state ownership. Does that impact our consideration for dynamism, innovation, et cetera?
Well, first, I'd say that I don't think that moving in that direction in some ways in terms of some of the Scandinavian countries and the things that they do wouldn't be positive on a number of levels. But I'd also say that their system, as much as they call it socialist,
it's not a full socialist system.
It's they really operate on a lot of capitalist principles in the way that they run it. And so, they've found what seems to be a nice happy medium between. You know, a central planned system, whatever you want to call that, whether it's socialism or communism or whatever you want to call it, and in this capitalist system, they found a balance. And I think that, we need to find a better balance as well in terms of the dynamism of capitalism with that kind of socialist or maybe not socialist, you know, just because of the weight that comes with that term, but the caring for everyone in the country and caring for having more equality and those elements that it does bring.
Social consciousness.
You got it.
Dr. Yelker.
Yeah, I think our students don't realize that we graduate them and they are contributing to this capitalist economy. They get employed with private equity firms mostly, not to say that they're not, going to public firms, but they have an opportunity to shape capitalism. That's what I think we need to remind them, and they're not fully aware that, let's say, what will happen to them in a socialist economy. What if everything becomes state-controlled? Will they have the choices that they have? So you can't have both, right? So we can do the right thing with capitalism. You know, Alan talked about and Andrew talked about, companies are now putting out sustainability reports and corporate social responsibility reports as part of their regular annual reporting process. So there are things happening. Smaller, medium-sized businesses are doing the stuff, but they don't have the resources to actually publicize and do that. But I think that it's partly a lack of awareness. And if our students are saying that, you know, capitalism is bad for them, I don't think they're recognizing that they're fully participating in capitalism and they have an opportunity to really shape it.
All right. Alan, you want to add that?
I just want to commend Dr. Yelker for your position with teaching your students how to interview and that they can have an impact, because that's exactly how they have an impact on capitalism.
We have a lot of phone calls to work through and feedback as well, so we're going to get to that after our only break of the hour. We're talking to our guests about their thoughts on recent surveys from Gallup indicating that a majority of young Americans, 18 to 29 American adults, have a more positive view of socialism than capitalism and more suspicion of capitalism for the first time in many decades, if not ever, since they've been doing this kind of survey work. And you just heard Dr. Rami Yelker, who is Dean and Professor of Marketing in the School of Business at St. John Fisher College. Andrew Brady is a board member for RABEF, the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation, CEO of the Accelerate team, founder and co-chair of the local chapter of Conscious Capitalism, and Alan Ziegler from RABEF as well. Before the hour's out, by the way, they're going to tell you where they think you ought to be checking out more on whether it's firms of endearment, where to learn more about conscious capitalism, how to nominate a company for an ethical business award, etc. A lot to tell you about. But let's get to your phone calls, your critiques, and your support of capitalism next. Coming up in our second hour, Canada is getting ready to legalize marijuana across the country. What does that mean for the United States? Well, for our laws, it doesn't mean anything, but it could mean quite a lot to those who travel to Canada and want to come home, or for those who are working in the legal cannabis industry, both here and there. Questions at the border as Canada legalizes marijuana, coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you're on the phone, please be patient. I'd like to get to all of you before the hour's out. I want to briefly and quickly let you know about how you can be part of a special edition of Connections next week. Tuesday, October 9th, it's a week from tomorrow, both hours, noon to 2, we're discussing the opioid epidemic here in New York. That broadcast is going to take place in front of a live audience here at WXXI. First hour, you're going to hear from people in recovery who share their stories of hope and the challenges they face. Second hour, we're going to talk to local leaders in healthcare and law enforcement about the coordinated community response to the crisis in our area. And again, you can be part of that live studio audience. We'd love to have you. It's free, open to the public, but seating's on a first-come, first-served basis. So please let us know if you can that you'd like to be here. Well, mark your calendars as well, and we will see you here next Tuesday, October 9th, for that live edition of Connections, a rare studio audience, so to speak. Let's get to your phone calls. Bob in Penfield first. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, Evan. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
First of all, I'm thinking that today's universities and colleges are nothing but globalist, socialist, you know, indoctrination centers is all they are, bending the minds the wrong way. We've got young people today, a generation, who can't even mow daddy's yard. They have to pay somebody to mow the yard because 18-year-old junior, he can't do it, okay? The situation is, why should I be able to get up, go to work, figure it out smarter than my competition, and then be penalized to carry the dead weight? And I'll take it even further. I mean, socialism and liberalism is great until you run out of other people's money financing it for you. And I'll even take it a step further. If I could vote tomorrow to end the welfare system in this country, I would do it, sink or swim.
So there'd be no social support at all, you think?
None. No, because the nation's at that. We are at that threshold right now where we can't do it. It's been drained dry. None. Zero. Sink or swim. Hey, let me tell you something. My wife's parents came over to this country in 1957. She was pregnant with twins. They got dumped at Ellis Island and said, good luck. Okay? Good luck. Here you go. Yeah. And they made it. under a capitalistic idea. He went to work, he got smart, he made a better product than the other guys. And that, hey, have you ever seen a lion move over at the kill for the stupid lion who can't kill the zebra? Doesn't happen. The right. Dominant lions win.
I'm hearing you, Bob. I've got the point. Thank you for the phone call. Let me go around the table and just ask our guests what they think here. Andrew Brady.
Yeah, what immediately comes to mind is when we were talking about those Scandinavian countries, right, and some of the social safety net that they have. You know, think about what you would do as an individual in America if you feel like you don't have any kind of safety net. Would you be willing to take a big risk to be an entrepreneur? You know, or if you do have some level of a safety net or some way that you know that at least your basics will be taken care of or people will be there to help you, you'd be more likely to take a risk and it could lead to actually us becoming even more dynamic. And other things that I've seen, you know, I think that when you think about taking away some of those, whatever, I mean, he's talking about, it was Bob, right? Mm-hmm. Talking about getting rid of welfare programs or things like that. The chamber, to their credit, had a breakfast that I went to last year around there where they talked about the investments in early childhood education and that it's perhaps one of the best ROI activities you could possibly have. Does it cost money in the short term? Yes, absolutely. But then in terms of a level of impact that it has for people that are able to contribute to society, to be able to, you know, stay out of the jail system and all these sorts of things. I mean, the downstream impacts on a life are not only for that individual, but for the community are really profound. And so I'd like Bob to just think on a longer term time horizon, because yes, there may be some short term costs, but the long term almost always comes back to help.
Alan, do you agree with what you heard from Bob?
No, I don't. I think we do have a responsibility to take care of those who, from a systemic point of view, have started with a disadvantage. And the thing that comes to mind most quickly are people of color. For 200 to 300 years in this country, they have been demeaned, treated poorly, legislatively, and it's still happening. So they don't all start from the same starting line. And congratulations to Bob's in-laws who made it. But for every Bob's in-laws who made it, there's a ton of people who didn't make it because of the barriers that are put up. So sorry, Bob, but I disagree.
All right, but you are agreeing with Bob that capitalism was the best opportunity for his in-laws and family to have a chance to make it.
Absolutely.
But you wouldn't have capitalism and sweep away every bit of social safety.
No way.
Okay, Dr. Yelker.
I agree that, you know, we're all speaking in support of capitalism, but to Bob's comment that everybody has different skill sets. Four-year college is not for everyone. And so everyone needs to find what the fit is in that job market or in the capitalistic society. So one size fits all doesn't work. And so it's not that somebody's not working because particularly if we think that they're not working because they don't have a choice, mm-hmm. or by choice that they're not employed or not doing the job that they want to. I think it's a bigger social problem that we need to not impose that one size fits all to people. Skill sets are different.
Bob, I know a lot of high school students, a lot of college students, and a lot of recent college grads. I don't know a single one who can't mow a lawn. Mike in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment. You know, we tried a purely capitalist system post-Reconstruction and thereafter, and I think clearly the system failed. I think President Roosevelt recognized that in the 1930s with his recognition of 70% unemployment. So we tried this type of social construct, and unfortunately it failed. Fast forward, in 1960s, President Johnson then had to integrate the system where we now have today Medicaid and Medicare, and these systems are still viable in addition to that, Social Security, because prior to that, he recognized President Roosevelt of Hoovervilles in Washington, D.C. He recognized, Hoover kept saying on and on, everything's fine, the market's working, but American citizens recognized that they couldn't feed themselves, they were on bread lines, high unemployment, unfortunately find themselves homelessness was rampant. Fast forward, we tried these, we tweaked the system. And then the Republicans, unfortunately, took away some of the legal constructs whereby we tried to prevent this from happening again. And so we curtailed it back, Clinton, in terms of his program regards to the banking system, where he said, well, you know, you can diversify, you can do what you want, essentially eroding some of the New Deal regulations of the market. Fast forward, it crashed again. So these guys can propagate this notion that a purely capitalist system is viable, but unfortunately, his social history suggests unequivocally that it's not. I would like to hear your guest comment.
Yeah, Mike, thank you. I mean, I'm not sure our guests, taking the politics out of some of your statements, I don't think our guests disagree with you for the most part. But Dr. Yelker, you're the professor in the room, so let me turn to you for a brief answer to that. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's like I was listening and I'm trying to comment without getting political here. You know, it's the systems exist and we need them. You know, who was the guest there?
Mike.
Mike was talking about Medicare, Medicaid, and you know, these systems are needed and they exist. And occasionally we do have, you know, issues with them and misuse perhaps that comes to light. But I think you can't take away the framework of what these systems were created for, and we need it for a society to function.
All right, I want to rip through as many calls as I can because I've got more than, I'm starting to drown in phone calls, which is a good thing. Jared in Rochester. Go ahead, Jared.
Hi, all. I'd just like to see that there's a couple of issues here that we're kind of mixing up, and I'd like to separate them real quick. So capitalism and communism are both economic systems. Economic systems are systems by which we answer the scarcity problem of how to allocate our resources best and most efficiently. And so the difference between capitalism and communism is that in capitalism, you have private ownership of the means of production, and in communism, you have public ownership of the means of production, and that these issues are separate from having the state tax either businesses or the citizenship so as to provide, you know, a social safety net. You know, you can still have, you know, the state provide a social safety net through wealth redistribution absent of the system that you're using. And, you know, referencing these Scandinavian countries are not socialist. They're very, very capitalist. They often end up on, you know, the top of the economic freedom indexes because they are so capitalist. And again, that they, while they do have strong social safety net programs, they have very high taxes and very strong wealth distribution programs. These are powered by the engine of capitalism, and you wouldn't have, you know, the presumed benefits that come out of this if not for this capacity, this engine of capitalism. And if you want to see what the other alternative is of using socialism as the and still having attempting to do wealth distribution, you know, please look at Venezuela and the catastrophe that is going on right there, that people are literally starving in the streets, you know, the great social upheaval. Socialism is a terrible answer to whether or not you want to provide a social safety net to the citizenship.
Jared, thank you. Any disagreement or agreement from guests on that?
You know, the one thing that just from the last two callers I'd like to put in there is when we think about at the cellular level, when we have unrestrained growth, you know, we call that cancer. Cancer is just continues to multiply. It's basically it's looking after its own self-interest without thinking about the well-being of the whole. And what happens with cancer is that, yes, it continues to grow and grow and grow, but then it ends up killing the whole. And so I think that you have to think about that in groups or in our bodies. For example, we have an immune system that's supposed to you know, tamper down some of that unrestrained growth. And similarly, in an economy, we need some kind of immune system of this, you know, whether you want to call it socialist or whether you want to call it, you know, redistribution or whatever, where you need to take into account, you know, some limits on growth, limits on monopolies and those sorts of things, because, you know, nothing in nature can grow forever. There has to be some limits on that growth. And so I'd agree with the points that were being made there. And thank you for helping us to really be clear on the terms that we're using as well.
All right. As fast as we can keep it moving, Nick. Oh, boy, I almost spilled water on our system. We would have bought a new one. Nick, go ahead.
Nick. Hello.
Is that you, Nick?
Yeah, Nick, yeah. You know, I wanted to comment that generational difference in terminology. One, that socialism for young people is different than older generation think of it as like totalitarianism and dictatorships. And younger people think of it as fairness and equality. And the older generation thinks of capitalism like wealth and independence, and young people think of it as greedy and abusive. And there's a sense that capitalism has to, that greed is an integral part of capitalism for young people. And it isn't necessarily, but it might be just an integral part of how capitalism works.
All right, so this is interesting.
Greed in capitalism.
Yeah, Nick, thank you. I mean, obviously we all think of Gordon Gekko and, greed, for lack of a better term, is good. But let me ask our guest briefly, philosophically, do you believe that we have to accept that poverty will always exist in some non-zero form, in some rather significant form, under capitalism or anything else? Or is that not true? Do you think that you can have a capitalistic society and also largely eradicate poverty? Andrew Brady.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think that as capitalism continues to create more and more abundance, we should be continuing to raise that level of what are the minimum standards that people should live by. For a while it was maybe just food, and then food and shelter, and now we're talking about food and shelter and healthcare. And so I think that as we create more, use the surplus that gets created from a capitalist system to the betterment of society as a whole, I think we can continue to raise that bar.
Can you do that without the government telling the people who get the surpluses, you've got to spread that around?
I think that in some cases, we do need to force the issue a little bit. Okay. Capitalism does create inequalities. We were talking about some of the monopolies, that happen. And sometimes that's just because it feeds on itself, right? Like Google becomes the best internet search engine, then it becomes even a larger and larger and larger slice of the pie. And so you do need to, restrain that and make sure that other competitors have a chance to come in.
Okay, Dr. Yelker?
I agree. I think the systems need to be managed. Otherwise, as Andrew said, if it gets out of control, then it becomes one extreme or the other, and the disparity, continues to increase. Not that poverty doesn't exist in socialistic societies. I've traveled in all kinds of Scandinavian countries. Everybody in Sweden is average, but you still see certain sectors and pockets where poverty exists exactly like it exists in capitalistic societies. So I think that I'm on the same page with Andrew that we need to manage it well. And if things get out of control, we need to have systems in place that bring it back to, in a systemic way, that there is a minimum level of lifestyle that everybody has.
Okay, Alan.
Just quickly, I think there's a real danger if we try to use broad brushes to describe these issues. We're not, the Bobs who say anything socialistic is wrong and the capitalists who say everything capitalistic is right. That's just not true. And it's to the point you're making of managing systems. When you talk about poverty, can it be totally eradicated? Sadly, probably not. But I do think of the fact that when I will plead guilty to this, occasionally go to McDonald's for a quarter pounder with cheese, I realize that the price is right for me because the guy serving it to me is being underpaid. And I ask myself, do I feel good about that? Do I feel good about him helping pay for my hamburger? That's the kind of thing that can be corrected.
Peter in Penyan says, sick people can't work. Therefore, universal health care can make capitalism more productive. Bismarck knew this in 1883. Why is that such a hard sell here? Can you have capitalism and universal health care?
Absolutely.
Okay, Andrew?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Dr. Yelker, capitalism and universal health care?
Well, it's a complicated question, but it's possible.
Okay, probably a whole other hour. John in Ithaca says, hey, Evan, for those who believe Scandinavian nations are actually capitalistic, I would be more than happy for us to switch to a Scandinavian style of capitalism. I suspect, John, as our political campaigns continue this year and in 2020, you'll hear more about that. Got to keep it really tight here as we get ready to down to our last 90 seconds. And I just want our guest to let you know where you think maybe you can think about kind of continuing to expand your thoughts on these subjects. Conscious capitalism, the book that sparked it was called, what was it called?
Firms of Endearment. Highly recommended, written by Raj Sisodia. And then in addition, we have a local chapter of Conscious Capitalism where every month we either go tour a local business that really cares about their corporate culture and or learn about a social entrepreneurship initiative. And we also do an annual conference. So we'd love to continue to grow the movement. And thank you, Evan, for the opportunity to
talk. How do they get in touch with you?
ConsciousCapitalismROC.org.
ConsciousCapitalismROC.org. Was that you guys at New City Cafe I saw you that one
yes,
time?
Yes, yes, it was.
It was awesome. I loved New City Cafe, and of course you guys were there on the day I was there. Ubiquitous, this man. The Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation is always interested in companies that want to nominate others or themselves for ethical business awards. It's a rigorous process, but how do you do that, Alan?
You go to rochesterbusinessethics.com, and everything is online. The application's online. We have mentors that will help you do that. And most important, I would invite you on October 22nd to come to Jiva Theater, where Evan Dawson will be emceeing our annual Ethi Awards program. And you'll see in this year 7 local companies who have proven that they have a high level of ethical cultures.
The only reason I do it is because I know you guys are a buzzsaw of judging, and you're tough.
It is a rigorous process.
It actually is. It's not just get nominated and win. And Dr. Yelker, are you an optimist for the future on this? I mean, I know there's a lot of young students are sort of pessimistic. Are you an optimist?
Oh, I'm an optimist, and so will our students be. Yeah.
Thank you for being here and for sharing your expertise. We've got fortunate students out there learning from you at St. John Fisher College. Dr. Rami Yelker, Dean and Professor of Marketing in the School of Business, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to Alan Ziegler. I'll see you in just a few weeks at the Ethies, the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation's annual awards. Thank you, as always, Alan.
Thank you, Evan.
And Andrew Brady, it is, let's see here, ConsciousCapitalismROC.org. See you there and everywhere else you are. I think you've been cloned. I see you everywhere.
Thank you, Evan. It's an honor to be here.
Nice to have you. Short break. More connections coming up.